Hello and welcome back to the Electronic Intifada's live stream for Wednesday, March 13th. Thank you all for tuning in. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman with my colleagues Ali Abunima, Asa Winstanley, John Elmer, and Tamara Nassar. It's day 159 of Israel's genocide in Gaza. We have another packed show for you today, including interviews with writer Wala Sabah and activist Huda Amori, and a full roundup of videos from the Palestinian armed resistance with John Elmer. But first, some of the news that we've been covering at the Electronic Intifada. The Palestinian Health Ministry in Gaza said that as of Tuesday, more than 31,000 Palestinians have been killed and nearly 73,000 injured since October 7th, with many more thousands missing or buried under the rubble. At least 27 people, 23 of whom are children, have been recorded dying from starvation and dehydration as Israel, supported by the U.S., continues to prevent international aid convoys from entering the Gaza Strip. Israeli forces now routinely fire on crowds of Palestinians who meet the trickle of aid that is able to enter the northern Gaza Strip, with massacres of hungry people happening every day. The Gaza government media office said on Tuesday that, quote, the casualties of Israel's targeting of hungry people while waiting for aid has reached over 400 victims and over 1,300 injuries so far. Israel's practices, quote, confirm that the policy of starvation is currently a hallmark of Israel's plan, alongside its perpetration of acts of genocide and ethnic cleansing, the office stated. The health ministry said on Tuesday that, quote, the ground aid that arrives in the northern Gaza Strip is very, very small. It is not enough for anyone. This aid arrives through two routes. First, Salah Ad-Din Street, where there is a traffic island that was built by Kuwait, so it is called the Kuwait Roundabout. The other place is Al-Bahar Street at the Nablusi intersection. Hungry people gather in these two places hoping to get any food. Bombing gatherings of hungry people has become a daily routine, the ministry explained. Quote, it is practiced by the occupation and the international community sees it on screens. Hunger will destroy all the residents of the northern Gaza Strip. Aid is very little. The price of a meal may mean certain death. Help the residents of the north. Do not leave them prey to hunger, bombing, and disease. The doctors will die, the nurses there will die, and the world will witness the largest number of victims of hunger in the coming days. If you do not act today to save us, we will all die, the Palestinian Health Ministry stated. Instead of forcing Israel to abide by its legal obligations to not starve people and opening the various ground crossings to the thousands of aid trucks, the U.S. and other Western countries, supported by Jordan's Air Force, continue to drop meager amounts of aid by the air. On March 8th, one such airdrop killed at least five people, including a child, when the parachutes failed to open. Al Jazeera reported earlier today that airdropped parcels fell on solar panels at Al-Ahli Baptist Hospital in Gaza City, destroying the panels which provide essential electricity to the hospital, which has, of course, already been bombed by Israel. A video of children rushing to gather what looks like pasta or grains that spilled from an airdropped parcel circulated on social media on Tuesday. Another video from yesterday shows children and elders sifting rice from the dirt after an airdrop in northern Gaza. The United Nations Agency for Palestine Refugees reported today that at least one staff member was killed and another 22 were injured when Israeli forces hit a food distribution center in the eastern part of Rafah in the southern Gaza Strip. The agency's Commissioner General Philippe Lazzarini said, quote, today's attack on one of the very few remaining UNRWA distribution centers in the Gaza Strip comes as food supplies are running out. Hunger is widespread, and in some areas turning into famine. Every day we share the coordinates of all our facilities across the Gaza Strip with parties to the conflict. The Israeli army received the coordinates, including of this facility, yesterday. Children are continuing to bear the brunt of Israel's starvation policy. A 6-year-old child, Fadi Alzant, is currently hospitalized with effects of severe starvation and dehydration at Kamal Adwan Medical Center in the northern city of Beit Lahia. According to reports and interviews with his mother, Fadi has cystic fibrosis, which requires a specific diet as well as critical medications that are impossible to obtain in the Gaza Strip now due to Israel's ongoing blockade. Fadi's mother, Shaima, said in an interview that her 2 other children, who also had cystic fibrosis, died in recent years. Quote, "I am afraid of losing Fadi," she said. And the charity Save the Children released a report this week saying that, quote, 5 months of violence, displacement, starvation, and disease on top of nearly 17 years of a blockade have caused relentless mental harm to children in Gaza. The report stresses that, quote, parents noted that children have given up on their hopes or ambitions for the future, and that, quote, in the context of the current unprecedented humanitarian catastrophe in Gaza, all the factors reported indicate that mental health consequences of this crisis will be more severe and more long-lasting than in other situations. Furthermore, these risks are known to be cumulative. The more risk factors children face, the greater the likelihood of poor and lasting mental outcomes, Save the Children added. The United Nations estimates that Israel's bombardments of residential units and other properties over the last 5 months have produced approximately 23 million metric tons of debris and rubble across Gaza. Agency partners report that it would take around 8 years to clear the debris, given existing capacities in the Strip, the UN adds. In her essential and wide-ranging analysis, the Electronic Intifada's senior editor Maureen Claire Murphy writes that, quote, "The statistics from the last 5 months in Gaza, as horrifying as they are, only provide a glimpse of the Holocaust that Palestinians there have endured, and without an immediate ceasefire, the worst may be yet to come." The following is a long excerpt from Maureen's piece. Israel's destruction and forced evacuation orders have displaced most of Gaza's population of 2.3 million Palestinians, many of them repeatedly. Some 1.5 million people now are concentrated in Rafah along Gaza's boundary with Egypt. Benjamin Netanyahu, Israel's prime minister, said the military will invade Rafah regardless of any temporary pause. The U.S., meanwhile, has made clear that it will not impose any material consequences on Israel should it invade Rafah without a plan to protect civilians. Human rights groups and humanitarian agencies have made clear that such a plan is an impossibility, despite being well aware that such an operation would entail mass casualties and spell the end of already severely restricted humanitarian aid missions in Gaza. The forcible transfer of Palestinians ever southwards in Gaza has given rise to alarm that Israel intends a mass expulsion of the people from the territory to Egypt's Sinai Peninsula, where there has been recent land clearing and construction to potentially contain a population forced from the Strip. The Biden administration says it is opposed to this, with White House National Security spokesperson John Kirby saying that, quote, "We don't want to see Gaza occupied, we don't want to see any of Gaza's territory reduced, and we don't want to see any forced displacement of the Palestinian people." But Israel is directly contradicting all 3 of those principles, with its intelligence ministry recommending the, quote, "evacuation of the civilian population from Gaza to Sinai," a blatantly illegal policy being implemented on the ground by the military, which has destroyed wide swaths of civilian infrastructure for a buffer zone on Gaza territory, also a glaring violation of international law. And the Israeli War Cabinet's recently revealed post-Hamas plan calls for indefinite direct Israeli military control of the territory. Even calling Netanyahu's document a plan is a stretch, with Haaretz writer Alon Pinkas describing it as an unserious negation of the Biden plan, a list of statements that constitute open-ended Israeli control of Gaza with no political silver lining. The Netanyahu plan calls for civil governance in Gaza to be handled by local elements with management experience, who are independent from countries or entities that support terrorism, seemingly an attempted revival of the village leagues that were intended to counter the revolutionary influence of the Palestine Liberation Organization in the 1970s and 80s. It also includes an Israeli-controlled buffer zone in Rafah along the border with Egypt. Biden's plan, by contrast, envisions an international force in Gaza, an extension of governance by a revitalized Palestinian Authority to the territory, which Netanyahu and members of his far-right government reject. What the Netanyahu and Biden plans have in common is a presumption that Israel will, in fact, remove Hamas as a governing entity in Gaza, hardly a foregone conclusion, as U.S. intelligence officials told members of Congress in February. Netanyahu and the Biden administration also share a total disinterest in how Palestinians wish to organize and govern themselves, more of the same denial of self-determination that is at the heart of the Palestinian national liberation struggle. That was a long excerpt from Biden's Regime Change Agenda Prolongs Gaza Genocide by Maureen Claire Murphy on electronicintifada.net. And finally, last night in the occupied West Bank, the Israeli military stormed the Jenin governmental hospital in the northern city of Jenin, killing two Palestinians and injuring five inside the emergency room. Palestinian resistance brigades in Jenin battled invading Israeli forces throughout the night. And in Jerusalem, the Israeli army killed a 12-year-old boy, Rami Hamdan al-Halhouli, in the Shufat refugee camp. The child was lighting a firework to celebrate Ramadan when Israeli forces shot him and then arrested him, according to reports. He was transferred to a nearby hospital and pronounced dead. Israel's National Security Minister Itamar Ben-Gvir went to the police station to show his support for the cops who shot and killed the child, calling the child a terrorist who put the Israeli forces at risk.
שאני אומר לכל השוטרים, אני נותן לכם גב. חברים, אתם אומרים, ילד בן 12, ודאי עם זה. ילד בן 12 שהוא מחבל. ילד בן 12 שסיכן לוחם שלנו. ילד בן 12 שזורק זיקוקים וזורקים בקבוקי תבירה, ברמות בקבוקי תבירה, בשואפת בקבוקי תבירה.
יש הבדל בין רמות על כביש.
That was Itamar Ben-Gvir. And also on Tuesday, a 23-year-old man, Zayd Khalifa, was shot and killed by Israeli soldiers near the Al-Jib military checkpoint in Jerusalem. And that's just some of the news from on the ground in Palestine over the last few days. Please go to electronicintifada.net to read some of our fantastic new features by writers in Gaza, now up on our homepage. And you're watching and listening to the Electronic Intifada live stream. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman. Coming up, we'll have an interview with Palestine actionist Huda Amori, and we'll get a full update from John Elmer on the latest military developments from the resistance in Gaza. But first, we're joined by Ali Abu Nima and Wala Sabah, a writer from Gaza who now lives in the UK. Wala is the Community Outreach and Partnership Officer at We Are Not Numbers, the collective of young writers in Gaza. Wala, thank you so much for being with us today on the Electronic Intifada live stream.
Thank you so much, Noura.
Welcome, Thanks. Wala.
Yeah, welcome. Tell us about your family in Gaza, what you know of their whereabouts and safety right now.
So my family is well as many of the Palestinian families were displaced from the northern part of Gaza Strip to the south. Now they're staying in a tent in a displacement camp that was created for people who are displaced from the north. Situation is really dire at this moment. No access to food, electricity, water, or healthcare facilities. They're struggling daily, especially that Ramadan has come like a couple of days ago, and now they can't move around or this is the situation briefly. I have been talking to our writers in Gaza, our journalists in Gaza, and they have been experiencing lots of struggles and getting food aid. One of our writers and journalists there in Gaza, her name is Miram, and she told me that they have been waiting in a line for 6 hours to get only one cucumber with a couple of potatoes and some vegetables. She said they are depending on canned food, which is not healthy for them, eating for 6 months so far, and this is affecting their overall health. No electricity, as I said. They are taking showers in a sea directly because the Al-Mawasi refugee displacement camp in Khan Yunis is right next to the sea. So they are taking showers in a sea, which giving them some skin problems and inflammation. She said they have to go to Rafah to be able to get a treatment, and the medications is not available. My sister personally, she's a pharmacy student and in her second year, and because there is no one in the camp to provide any healthcare support for them, so she's taken lead and she has transferred my parents' living tent into a medical point for people to be able to get access to help. She's helping with the minimum she can. Because they have wounded people in the camp. They also have women who give birth. So she's taken lead of supporting those women, changing on their wounds, helping the children as well in their problems, and women in their inflammation. But again, they do not have any medications at this moment, and they have to go by themselves if available, like in Gaza.
Well, thank you for telling us about your family, and I'm so sorry to hear that what they're going through is exactly what we hear from almost everyone in Gaza. I want to ask you, Ramadan has just started in the past days. How is life different for people in Gaza during Ramadan? Are people trying to observe Ramadan, or is it simply impossible given the scarcity of food and the need to just be able to eat whenever they can? What do you know about that?
Okay, so you understand that moving around is not an easy task for them because they prefer not to move it during the day. So now moving to Rafah and having access to medical facilities there and food aid agencies is not as easy as before. They only depend on one meal a day that is provided after the sunset. And that meal is provided by food agencies to them. But they are not, of course, it's not like any of the Ramadans we survived before. There is no joy. They're not able to enjoy the family gatherings they used to have in the past. Again, they depend on canned food, nothing healthy. I feel that they should have like at least one healthy meal a day, which they cannot, as many of them have told me. They said again, there's nothing that hasn't changed. The same food they are eating, if available, it's only about canned food, no vegetables. They said they had to wait in a line to get two eggs from UNRWA a couple of days ago, and many of them were making fun that they paid for the transportation more than the eggs worth. But yeah, that's the food situation there.
Wala, what are people saying about these absurd and lethal airdrops that are, being coordinated by Jordan, but used by Western countries, mostly the U.S. and some European countries, to circumvent not having to pressure Israel to open the crossings and let these thousands of aid trucks that are idling at these crossings in. What are people saying about what's happening with these airdrops?
I mean, it's not only my opinion, but it's quite ridiculous what's going on right now. Like dropping aid, why not just asking people to die, but asking Israel to kill people while they're full, not when they're empty stomach. So people want a ceasefire. This is what they are asking for. And then they can have the aid because the aid is stuck like in Egypt at this moment without access to Gaza. What people are asking for now is not food. They want a ceasefire, and then the food is important, but the ceasefire comes first. The U.S. is the same. The U.S. has dropped food aid as well, food parcel and people, but they were making fun of the what these food parcels contain. It doesn't even align with what Palestinians eat or what type of food it has, like very dried food as well, like pieces of salt and black pepper. They were making fun of the type of food. It's just like, it's more of like show off that we are doing something while the U.S. kind of stop what's going on right now, but doesn't want to do so. Palestine, also Jordan, joined this food drop in. But again, people are not happy and not satisfied. It killed people. Like they're doing it even wrong. That is making people's life worse. People are not satisfied with this. I heard it from many of our journalists in Gaza, especially from We Are Not Numbers, that they were making videos of those food aid and saying that doesn't make any sense for them. And they wanted an immediate ceasefire before showing off that we're helping Gaza because they're not helping them.
And what about these plans that have been announced to set up a port to deliver aid, that the United States is going to build a port or a way for ships to land? And even the news that the first ship carrying aid has just left Cyprus. What are people saying about that? What's their perception of these plans?
Honestly, people don't have any trust in the U.S. People in Gaza don't have any trust in the U.S. at this moment. So they have suspicions of what's behind this board, what's behind this medical aid support that's coming from that port. Many people are just so suspicious, and they are staying alerted about something bad coming soon from this port. They're not encouraged. They're not enthusiastic about it. They said the U.S. could have stopped this war and then started the port, but they decided with the port without ending the war. So
What are some of their fears or concerns about the port? Because I've heard some people outside Gaza say, oh, well, any way of getting aid in is a good thing. Why wouldn't people in Gaza feel that way?
Well, when people are outside of Gaza, they are not experiencing what people in Gaza they are experiencing, right? And it's just like being an outlooker at what's going on in Gaza. What makes sense for those people? Because people in Gaza know that they are experiencing the war themselves. And then if they're experiencing it, they know that the U.S. has been supporting killing the Palestinians from day one and supporting Israel's side over Palestinians. So why not? The first question, the main question is, well, why not ending the war first and then creating this port and supporting Palestinians? That's a logical question, honestly, from a person who's seeing the situation from the outside. Why not ending the war and then provide as many aid as you want? Why not in so many, so far, like over 30,000 Palestinians were killed, more than 12,000 children were killed. And what's next? What are we waiting for? Number of malnutrition, people dying from famine as well. What we're waiting for is it's not about food. It's about ending the war in Gaza. And more than this is America is the U.S. has been suspicious, like have lots of suspicions about its operations in Gaza and about having a military base in Israel that was recently discovered or even shown in the media. So Palestinians are having are fearing afraid that that Gaza will be under Israeli occupation now, under the Israeli presence for a long period. Now it's 6 months. The very beginning, they thought it's going to be 1 week, 2 weeks, and then 1 month, and now we are 6 months, and it's extending. It's not stopping. So this port, if the aid will keep coming, this means that the war will extend for like probably a year or even more, who knows. So that's, Ali, the main concerns of the Palestinian people in Gaza.
Wola, can you talk a little bit about your work with We Are Not Numbers and And the, you know, the community that you have helped build there, and what some of your contributors and colleagues are, how are they doing right now? What's happening with We Are Not Numbers?
First of all, We're Not Numbers is a youth-led Palestinian project. It's in Gaza. It was founded in 2015. The We're Not Numbers project focuses on training young people in Gaza Strip and as well as in many other regions in the world, Canada, Turkey, US, UK, in journalistic writing and how to defend Palestine, how to present the Palestinian case in the media. We wanted them to talk on their behalf, not to have people talking on their behalf. We have many people, like over 300 Palestinian writers and journalists in Gaza Strip at this moment. They're writing, and the Electronic Intifada has already partnered with some of them. They are all displaced. The majority, if not all, the people I know are displaced to the south of Gaza. We have a couple of our writers in the north. Unfortunately, many of our writers were killed, including Yusuf Dawaz, as well as Huda Susi, Mahmoud and Na'ouk. They were all writers for We're Not Numbers. They were tragically killed by Israeli airstrikes on the Gaza Strip. So far, as I said before, as I mentioned, our writers are displaced. They're experiencing lots of struggles. Many of them are trying to get out of Gaza desperately to continue with their education. They haven't continued their education. They're still in their university bachelor's degree. They are so worried about their future. They are so worried about their family's future as well. They don't know if they will survive, and if they will survive from the bombing, if they will survive from the famine happening right now. So, but they are so optimistic about writing about Palestine. They want to tell what's going on. They feel that they are witnessing. There are eyewitnesses of what's going on at this moment. So they want to tell the world what's going on. And I feel proud that they are doing so.
We're very proud of them as well. And as you mentioned, we've had the privilege to work with many of the We Are Not Numbers writers. And we credit We Are Not Numbers for training and supporting and nurturing so many wonderful journalists and creative writers in Gaza. And that's been tremendously valuable to us in our mission of telling the stories of Gaza. We offer our condolences for the We Are Not Numbers writers who have been killed. And we note that Israel is targeting intellectuals and writers. They're being killed just because they're Palestinians in Gaza, and everyone is being killed, but they're also targeting specific writers, journalists, intellectuals, university presidents, one of whom was our dear friend, Dr. Rifat Al-Arir. And he worked closely with We Are Not Numbers, I understand. Can you say a little bit more about his work and the legacy he left with We Are Not Numbers?
Dr. Rifat Al-Arir is a very incredible, amazing person in terms of academic life, in terms of passionate person about the stuff he's doing. He's one of the co-founders of We Are Not Numbers. He has been there since its establishment. He's been training our writers on journalistic writing and how to advocate for Palestine and for the Palestinian rights. Many people are so grateful for him, for his contribution to Palestine. Since day one, he has been training our writers in Gaza. He's been providing sessions for We Are Not Numbers writers. He always encouraged them to write. He provided training on academic writing as well as feature writings and how to be careful about the terminology. He was so focused on this. Of course, our project is in English, so he also provided like proofreading for some texts. And he also helped connecting some of our writers to international magazines and online websites so they can talk and write for them and to have their voice heard all over the world.
And that work continues, and that's very important. And we continue to honor Dr. Rifat by continuing his mission, and we're grateful to you and your colleagues for doing that as well. And is there a way, people are asking us, is there a way people can help and support the mission of We Are Not Numbers?
At this moment, We Are Not Numbers. Also, at the very beginning, we started as a voluntary program. So what we are doing is that they write for us, and then we help them to connect to international organizations, websites, and news agencies. At this moment, we decided that we're going to pay for our writers. What we do now is just pay for their pieces to help and support them financially. They are always can donate to We Are Not Numbers website if they would like to, and then their contribution will go directly to our writers in Gaza.
That's
wonderful.
Great.
And finally, just about your own work, Wala. You're far away from your family and community and neighborhood in Gaza. You're doing this incredible work with We Are Not Numbers. You've contributed to the Electronic Intifada recently. Here's your author page. Tell us about what's next for you and how you are continuing to do, you know, this honorable work of journalism and providing, a voice from the ground.
Well, this is the least thing I can do, Nora. I'm not with my family, although I wish I was there when the war has started. It feels so sad that I'm all right in a safe place while they're experiencing all this by themselves. At the same time, I feel that I can help and reflect what's going on from here and support them in terms of food and stuff more than if I was in Gaza. What I'm doing is just writing about what's going on, trying to show the world the suffering of Palestinian people, what they have to experience during this war. And that's the least I can do. I'm also part of so many initiatives in Gaza to provide some. We're currently providing some solar panels to try to repower Gaza, or at least helping Palestinians in some displacement camps to repower their camps, especially during the months of Ramadan. I'm also part of many initiatives supporting food to Gaza. I'm in the middle of one right now. So this is what I can do, writing, participating in those initiatives, trying to get to support the Palestinian community, especially our writers in Gaza.
Hmm. Wala Sabah, thank you so much for joining us today on the Electronic Intifada live stream. We have the website URL for We Are Not Numbers down there at the bottom of the screen, wearenotnumbers.org. Thank you so much for being with us, and we hope to have you back on really soon. Thank you so much, Wala.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Wala.
Wonderful. And you are listening to and watching the Electronic Intifada live stream. I'm going to throw it to Asa, who's going to join us, and we're going to bring on Huda Amori.
Thanks, Nora. Today, we're welcoming back to the show Huda Amori, who's a co-founder of Palestine Action. Welcome back to the show, Huda.
Thank you. Thank you for having me, and thank you for all the work you've been doing.
Yeah, hi, Huda. Thank you for coming on. We're glad you could. Palestine Action was founded, as I think most of our viewers and listeners will know, nearly four years ago now, in 2000, the summer of 2000, by activists who wanted to go beyond marches and speeches and try and actually stop the Israeli war machine in its tracks physically. And their main target has been Elbit, Israel's largest private arms manufacturer. I think Elbit had 10 factories and offices in the UK, but now only has 8. Is that right, Huda?
Yes, so they had to shut down their Oldham site, and they left their London offices, but they have got another site now in Bristol, which they've been building for the past few years.
So the Bristol site is more is sort of the head office now in the UK. Is that right?
Yeah, so they have a headquarters in Bristol, Aztec West 600, and they also have a manufacturing research site, which they recently launched with the help of the Israeli embassy. But actually, interestingly, the Aztec West site in Bristol is owned by Somerset Council. So this is the only Elbit site which is actually owned by a local government, and there has been a concerted campaign against that council to evict Elbit.
And Huda, you recently wrote about how you, and just in the last few months, you and your comrades at Palestine Action have forced, I think, three companies, or is it four companies, to break their ties with Elbit Systems, which is, of course, the largest Israeli weapons manufacturer. What are those companies, and how did you force them to break their connections with Elbit?
Yeah, so the first one that cut ties was IO Associates, and they were the sole recruiters for Elbit Systems. They did all of their recruitment services for them, and they cut ties with Elbit after a two-month campaign, which involved activists storming into their offices. Actually, activists stormed into their brand new Manchester offices on the day they opened it, and they were kicked out of those offices after actions against them after about a month. And, you know, we had red paint sprayed over their different offices across the country, and it took 2 months for them to announce to us that they are cutting the contract with Elbit Systems. And we actually had someone inside IO Associates who left the company because of their work with Elbit Systems confirm that Elbit Systems was their biggest client. So that was quite significant for them to do so. After that, it was Fisher German. So that's been a 2-year campaign, and Fisher German managed the property of Elbit's factory in Shenstone. And there has been several, you know, dozens of actions against them over the past 2 years. And then they announced to us that they are cutting all ties with Elbit Systems. And then after that, we had the website designers. Yeah, the website designers of Elbit's Leicester factory. It took one action. Someone spray painted drop UAV on their offices, and they wrote to us immediately saying that they are no longer hosting the website for Elbit's Leicester factory and will not work with the company in the future. And then the last, but perhaps most significant, was Crane and Nagel. They are one of the world's largest shipping companies, a multi-billion pound multinational company. And they are one of only six companies who are actually licensed for the secure collection and transport of weapons and firearms. And they also wrote to us to confirm that they cut the contract of Elbit and to ask us to cease the campaign against them. And I think these string of victories signifies the growth of our campaign, as well as the strategy to also expand to their whole supply chain. Elbit can't operate if they don't have landlords to house them, if they don't have suppliers, they don't have recruiters. And even if they start looking for other, you know, other services by other companies, they will start reducing that. The pool that they can choose from will be reduced. They'll get lower value. It's a massive distraction for them, a massive headache. And ultimately, it's mounting the pressure on Elbit Systems and their viability to continue operating.
And clearly, it's working. That's really impressive. And we've spoken about in live streams in the last few weeks that at least two major Japanese companies have also cut ties with Elbit Systems. And this also followed protests and grassroots organizing in Japan. Do you talk about internationally, you know, not just Palestine Action, because we last time we had you on, you talked about Palestine Action expanding to the US and I think now to Belgium as well. And also these actions in Japan, which are not Palestine action, but are also targeting Elbit systems. Just give us a sense of the international picture in addition to these really incredible victories in the UK.
Yes, so we've seen the campaign against Elbit massively expand. There was an international day of action organized by Progressive International, and we saw people in Brazil taking action against Elbit over there. Like you said, also in Japan, across Europe, in America as well, in the US. And also we're seeing more actions, a lot of actions actually, in Australia with people taking action against Elbit, occupying rooftops of weapons companies. So the international campaign is really becoming extremely strong and more of a threat to Elbit systems globally. You know, when we were targeting Elbit systems, we try and focus at where we are and our context and what we can do from our country. But seeing how other places, other campaign groups, other movements, Palestine Action expands as well, is becoming a global campaign against Elbit systems. We're threatening their interests everywhere. And ultimately, that is applying a much bigger threat towards Elbit systems and ultimately the Israeli military. And Elbit's name is being tarnished through these actions left, right and centre across the world. And I think that's a key thing as well, is within the Palestine movement, we all need to know the names of the companies who are supplying the Israeli military, who are supplying these missiles, drones, munitions to massacre the Palestinian people, because a lot of them, especially Elbit, are operating right in front of us. And it's a tangible way for us to impact the Israeli military apparatus across the world.
Yeah, I mean, it really sounds like Palestine Action, and it sounds like you've sort of expanded your victory since the last time you came on the show. I want to play a clip of the what you mentioned earlier about Somerset Council. These are the kinds of actions you've been doing. Palestine Action volunteers.
Aztec West for the last 3 years. Elbit Israel, we've seen the list. Elbit Israel is also on the lease. It's not enough now to wash your hands and sell it. You should be terminating the lease and kicking Elbit out.
Over 26,000 Palestinians have been slaughtered, over 12,000 children killed, over 66,000 injured, and the majority of Gaza is displaced.
Thanks, Tamara. Maybe you can mute that now. Yeah, so, I mean, it's just... So these are council sessions, right, where they're discussing the business of the local council.
Yeah, exactly. So all councils have public meetings and are open to the public. And Somerset Council, it came to light recently that they are selling off, they are planning to, I'm not sure if it's on the market yet, sell off the property of Elbit Systems headquarters at Aztec West 600, but we made it very clear that that is not adequate simply after 3 years of being complicit in the genocide and housing these war criminals. It is not good enough to simply say, well, we're going to sell it on and it won't be our problem and we won't be complicit. Actually, they now have a moral and legal responsibility to cut the lease of Elbit Systems and evict them before they sell on the property. And we know that there is a clause that says that if the tenant is doing anything immoral or illegal on the premises, then they shouldn't be in there in the first place. And I mean, what better case for an immoral and illegal company than Elbit Systems, whose CEO, who said that they are crucial to the genocide, has boasted about their contracts with the Israeli military during this genocide, and is also on the board of Elbit Systems UK. And, you know, arguably by them doing this, they are making, and these are Somerset residents as well who are taking part in this campaign, who are, you know, really annoyed that they have been forced to be complicit in this genocide in such a direct way through these councillors. And, you know, one of the hypocritical statements that have come out from this council is that they want a, that they voted for a ceasefire in Gaza. You vote for a ceasefire while you're literally harboring the murderers of the Palestinian people. And I think we have to cut through these, you know, false statements of a show of support and actually make them, you know, actions speak a lot louder than words. And it's time for Somerset Council to kick Albert out.
Well, I think it's brilliant whenever people can bring the issue right down to the most local level. You know, I know that one of the comebacks that the government in the UK makes is to claim that, local councils have no business making resolutions about international issues. They should be focusing on local governance. And I think what this shows is that local councils are very directly involved, whether as property owners or whether they're supplying services to companies like Elbit System that are directly engaged in genocide. So I think that's brilliant. Asa, should we talk about another action that Palestine Action did? I'll just say as background here, a few years ago, I think it was in 2010, I visited Scotland and I was very honored to be hosted for a number of events in Scotland. And one of the things my host did is they took us to visit the estate of very lovely grounds and house of someone called Lord Arthur Balfour. And I thought when I saw that lovely country estate, I sort of making a declaration that this country estate now belongs to the Palestinian people. But you recently had some of your comrades had an action related to Balfour. Can we show that video, Tamara? And that is, of course, a painting of Arthur Balfour, who, of course, made the infamous Balfour Declaration when he was the British Foreign Secretary. That was in 1917, in which he essentially gave the blessing of the British imperial government to the Zionist plan to colonize Palestine and steal it from its indigenous Palestinian people. What's happening here, Huda?
So this was an action against the Balfour painting, which is in Trinity College at University of Cambridge. And as you can see, they pretty much destroyed that painting. It's worth noting as well that Trinity College do invest in Elbit Systems. But the main purpose of this action, I believe, was to highlight British complicity in the colonization of Palestine. And the fact that we are honoring figures like Balfour, and, you know, having his paintings up at University of Cambridge, yet most people in this country were not aware of Balfour's role. And by default, not necessarily as aware about Britain's historic role and current role in the colonization of Palestine. So I think this action really brought out, you know, a whole debate and conversation around Balfour and around British complicity. Which is good to see, because, you know, as Palestinians and obviously all of you will know about Balfour, will know about the Balfour Declaration. You know, we're raised up knowing the name of Balfour. But for British people, that's not necessarily the same. Yet he was a foreign minister in Britain when he signed away the land of Palestine without having the right to do so. So I think this has changed that. And actually, people do know the name of Balfour now, and understand, you know, what he did in to sign away a land which he never had any right to do. And I also think that, you know, the reaction, you know, we have actions all of the time in Palestine Action, and this one just went absolutely crazy. And I think that actually shows that the fact that it went viral in itself does show. Shows what society's views are in many ways, that they are shocked, so shocked about a painting that they didn't know existed being destroyed or torn apart. But yet that same reaction isn't given for when a museum is destroyed or universities are destroyed or families are massacred in Palestine. And so I think it highlights the moral inconsistencies in our society. And what do we really prioritize? Figures of Balfour or our role in genocide?
And also, I think it's, you know, many people will know that Balfour was the foreign secretary in 1917 when he issued, of course, the infamous Balfour Declaration. But people might not know that Balfour was also prime minister prior to that. In fact, it's a little bit of an echo of what we have now, where David Cameron, a former prime minister, is now the UK foreign secretary. And Balfour was a precedent for that. He became foreign secretary after being prime minister. And I believe that it was in 1905 that as prime minister, he pushed for the passage of the Aliens Act, which was not just a racist law, but a specifically, primarily intended at restricting Jewish immigration into the UK. And Balfour spoke up in the House of Commons in very derogatory terms about Jews in arguing for this law. So not only was Balfour an imperial racist, colonialist against Palestinians, against African people, against people in Asia, but he was very specifically and very avowedly an anti-Semite. So is it not amazing that in the UK, where there are witch hunts going on all the time and in the Labour Party over supposed anti-Semitism, which is often not anti-Semitism, it is advocacy for Palestinian rights, that an august institution like Trinity College at the University of Cambridge would be honouring a Jew hater like Arthur Balfour?
Exactly right. And I think that, you know, doing actions like this where people can, when these points are coming through to the public, I think, you know, we are always, as you say, there's witch hunts about anti-Semitism and accusations of it, yet we don't look at our own historic figures who were so anti-Semitic that they wanted to colonize the Palestinian people in order to stop Jews from immigrating into Britain. And I think it's uncovered a lot more context to more people about the historic motivations behind the creation of the Zionist entity and the displacement of the Palestinian people. And also that, you know, Palestinians are not the ones to blame for the anti-Semitism. It's often come from European countries who have then imposed their own racism and creating another form of, you know, systematic ethnic cleansing of the Palestinian people as a result. And also that this is continuing to this day. The complicity hasn't ended. It didn't end with Balfour. It began with Balfour in many ways, and it's continued to this very day. So rather than, you know, a lot of people will be sympathetic towards the Palestinian, but as people in Britain and in many different countries as well, we have to play more of an active role in fighting for the liberation of the Palestinian people, because it's not some issue that we are not connected with. Balfour and the British in many ways were the architects of allowing this to happen to the Palestinian people. And as people in this country who are opposed to that, we need to play an active role in breaking down that complicity and support for the occupation of the Palestinian people.
Yeah, I think the process you described, whereby there was a lot of controversy, public controversy in Britain over this particular action against this portrait of Balfour, very much reminded me of the destruction of the Edward Colston statue, the slave owner, who, you know, most people had not heard about before the statue was destroyed and dumped in the docks in Liverpool. It seems to me a very similar dynamic at play here, but maybe you could talk about has there been any legal repercussions for the person who did this? And then maybe transition from that into talking about the recent moves to sort of smear you by the British government as extremist.
Yeah, so they haven't arrested the person who did the action, as far as I know. They did arrest someone else. They arrested someone who did an action against the Balfour statue in the House of Commons 2 years before and was found not guilty by a court. So it's clearly they did a lot of thinking there to try and arrest that person who wasn't even in the country during the time of the action. You know, great police work over there, but no one has been arrested as of yet. Who actually, you know, partakes in the action. But in terms of, you know, the latest move, so we've seen Michael Gove, who is now trying to introduce a new definition of extremism, which they're going to announce tomorrow. And there's been a lot of leaked documents and, you know, there's been a lot of articles mentioning that Palestine Action is supposedly going to be on this list of extremists. In this country, which, you know, it's quite interesting to see how this government responds to the increased support for the Palestinian people.
What does it mean, extremist? Like, is this a like an actual prescription?
No. So apparently, according to Suella Braverman, we don't meet the bar for terrorism. So they're now trying to find a new category for extremism. But basically, as far as we understand, the most they can do is stop us from engaging with politicians and stop us from getting funding from councils and banners from speaking at universities. That is the kind of plans that they have for those who are labelled as extremists. They don't have the capacity to ban us. I mean, for us, that's not going to deter us. That's not going to stop us. And if anything, coming from a government who was so supportive and arguably is partaking in this genocide against the Palestinian people, for them to call us the extremists while they are so deeply complicit in the massacre of tens of thousands of Palestinians and the destruction of Gaza is laughable. And if we are seen as the opposite to them, then so be it. But in reality, most people in this country do not support genocide, do not consider those who are taking action to stop weapons manufacturers from partaking in genocide as the extremists, but instead those weapons manufacturers and the government are the extremists.
Well, it looks to me from what I've read about this is that, you know, if a government that that the UK thought was one of its adversaries engaged in this behavior of labeling civil society organizations, because of course it's likely not just to be Palestine Action, but perhaps a whole range of groups, including mainstream groups that support Palestinian rights or take other critical positions with respect to British policy and effectively American policy, because the government in London takes its orders from Washington, as we all know, that they label their opponents extremist, they ban them from speaking, and so on. It looks to me like the actions of a very authoritarian, anti-democratic regime in the UK.
Yeah, it also seems to be hugely Islamophobic. You know, Palestine Action is possibly going to be one, we'll find out tomorrow, but the vast majority of the others who've been named are Muslim organizations. And, you know, to have an extremist definition of any kind is absurd. But then to only include a certain subsection of society is massively racist and Islamophobic and, you know, complete opposite of democracy. Because what they're trying to say is that these are groups who undermine our democracy and undermine British values. But are we really at a time where we determine what values are British and that British values mean supporting a genocide? There are plenty of people in this country who do not think like that. And so it is subjective, and it's subjective to those in power who are partaking in a genocide and who don't want any criticism And, you know, we don't engage with politicians. We're a direct action group. So, you know, the fact that they don't want to engage with us isn't a big loss for us. But these Muslim organisations who actually represent a large part of Muslim society, for them to not, for the government to say, we're not going to engage with you, is insanity, in my opinion. It's the most anti-democratic thing they can do.
And sadly, this seems to be the direction so many of the Western so-called democracies are going, more and more repression, more and more demonization. And really, I think what we're seeing from the outpouring of horror at what Israel is doing, that these governments, I mean, they talk about isolating so-called extremists, but they seem to be completely isolated from their people. That seems to be the story. Even in Germany, one of the most fanatically pro-genocide governments in the country, I think they give the UK a run for its money in terms of their enthusiasm to see Palestinian blood spilled and to see Palestinians starved to death in a Nazi-like death camp, which is what Germany has helped turn Israel into. Even there, the most recent poll I saw from, I think it was from mid-January, maybe there's something more recent, that more than 60% of the German public oppose Israel's war on Gaza and only 25% support it. So this fanatically racist, bloodthirsty government in Berlin is completely out of touch with Germans. It seems to be the same story everywhere.
Yeah, I mean, we don't have a, you know, a democratic process in this country. I mean, I think we are going to see in the next election a lot of independents run, and you know, but we're still not going to make up. We're not going to have an accurate reflection of who supports the Palestinian people in Parliament, because the major parties just aren't going to allow that. They've been practicing the most anti-democratic stuff on Palestinian activists, on pro-Palestine activists, to stop us having a voice for years, if not decades. And so we are at a point in time where there isn't a democratic process in this country, and they're just trying to make that even worse. And they have become completely detached from what, you know, how normal people feel, and most people now will not vote for anyone. And I think as well with this government, it's all about, it's a political game for them. They have a general election coming up for them, you know, showing that they are being more Islamophobic. They think will gain them some votes by further dividing, you know, British society. And the fact that that's where we are in 2024, I think is cause for concern for everyone. But also, you know, I think it's further validates why we have to take the actions that we take in terms of direct action, because, you know, we cannot engage with these people. And, you know, there is a clear aim as well. You know, Michael Gove, he was extremely pro-Israel, right?
And he is, just for our viewers outside the UK, Michael Gove is the Home Secretary in the UK, who sort of like the Homeland Security Secretary in the US.
Yeah, he's been in for about 5 minutes. I mean, I can't, you know, there's a revolving door of these, you know, ministers who come in for a little bit of time.
And he's a really extreme Zionist, just to say. He's long been incredibly dedicated to Israeli racism for many, many years.
Yeah. So, I don't know, just if we want to, Huda, just because we're about to to wrap up, I wanted to show you this video. Sort of, maybe this is a very different kind of government minister compared to the ones you have in the UK. This is a short video clip from of the South African foreign minister, Naledi Pandor, and she was speaking a few days ago at an iftar in South Africa, in the Muslim community. And there's actually a 16-minute long video on YouTube of her comments, which are absolutely brilliant. We're not going to show the whole thing. Just want to show you this clip, if we can show it, Tamara.
What we all have to fight for here, and I've asked this everywhere I've spoken, if you have a few hours, could you take your time and just make a poster? The poster should read, "Stop Genocide." And go and stand outside 5 embassies. There are 5 primary supporters of Israel. I'm not going to name them for you. You must do your work. As the women in black did for us when we were fighting apartheid. Stand up and petition. Stand up and protest. Stand up and be visible. Don't only come to this dinner. Be visible in support of the people of Palestine. Be visible. Sign a petition. In Cape Town, I said they want to destroy UNRWA. Let's make sure we provide funding for it. I said this at the mosque. And alhamdulillah, our people have come forward. We've got money. We will send it to the comrades. So let us not just be visible in a protest march or in a meeting. Let's just take 10 of us, not many. And we say, today on Monday, for 2 hours, you'll be at this embassy. You'll be at that one. You'll be... Every day, it pinches that visibility. But our silence allows injustice. So let us stand up.
I just thought that indeed. Was such... Yeah, I just thought that was such an unusual thing for a foreign minister to say. And she also, elsewhere in her comments, supports boycott as well. I just wanted to get your reaction to that. How does that compare to what you hear from your foreign minister in the UK, for example?
Well, it's completely different, and it's extraordinary to see that. But, you know, our ministers are more obsessed with being seen as being supportive of Israel, no matter what they do in Gaza, and hasn't entertained at all supporting the Palestinian people. And, you know, like, for example, when we had this International Court of Justice ruling on genocide, we had the government's response about their arms sales was, well, even though their own laws ban them from selling arms, if there was a risk, it could be used in violations of international law, which the ICJ ruling clearly showed there was and they shouldn't be doing it. And their response was, well, Israel has told us that they won't be used in violations of international law. And, you know, and it went completely against the judgment, said we believe Israel has a right to defend itself. So they are willing to fly in the face of, you know, what we're supposed to be standing by, these international conventions and international law, in order to support the genocide of the Palestinian people.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much, Huda, for being with us again. We appreciate it. I'm sure we'll get you and perhaps others from Palestine Action on again in the future. How can viewers find out more about Palestine Action or support your work?
Our website's palestineaction.org, and our Twitter and Instagram is pal_action. And we are going to have training days in across the country in Britain, so you can watch out for those as well.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Huda, and thank you to you and all your comrades for your courageous, really courageous and exemplary work.
And thank you. And thank you for platforming us and for the work you do.
Thanks.
And yeah, thank you so much, Huda. That was phenomenal. And thanks, Asa and Ali, for that segment. You are watching and listening to the Electronic Intifada live stream. We're going to turn to John Elmer for the latest resistance news.
Hi, John.
Hi, guys. Good show.
Great thank show. Thank
you. It's great to hear from Wala and Huda. They're both doing great work.
Yeah, indeed. John, you have put together a package showing how fighters in Gaza have used drones against the Israeli military, something that not a lot of people have had the privilege of seeing or knowing about. So, yeah, set us off.
Let's get right into it then, Nan. Over the weekend, the Qassam Brigades carried out an attack by drone in the northeast of Gaza in Beit Hanun. So maybe we'll just go right to that video, Tamara, and get started. So this, what we're seeing here is a thermal imaging camera, apparently a night operation. We're looking down from a quadcopter, actually a hexacopter, six blades, over an IDF military camp in the northeast of Gaza. We can see there, we can see after this is dropped, you can see the white dots are the Israeli soldiers on this thermal camera. And you can see with this drone operation that the targeting is precise right along the bank there where the soldiers are based. And you can see in this footage that we're watching, if you're listening online, you can see them, the soldiers fleeing from the grenade that's dropped. And we're seeing a Gaza-built anti-personnel device that's being dropped. We're looking down, straight down now at an Israeli army camp. You can see their tents in their position inside of Gaza in the buffer zone. And we're seeing, again, a Gaza-made anti-personnel device dropped directly on top of the tent. Both of the munitions dropped from this drone hit their targets. Which is something that we have seen the Palestinians use several times throughout the course of this war that began on October 7th. And we saw the other day, Abu Ubaida gave a speech where he said that our forces appear where they least expect it. And so, yeah, here we go. Let me just show you this. This is the Israeli military camp, and just Tamara's frozen it here to show you the way that they have built these berms around their positions and how high they've gotten them in the 5 months that they've been working on this inside Gaza. So you can see they're creating these fortified camps. And so this drone activity, if we carry on from here, Tamara, you can see that the drone activity gets you immediately over top of this camp. And the precision with which these drone strikes are used by Palestinians is remarkable. And we saw it on October 7th as well. If we could just go to number two here, Tamara. There's a series of operations. The principal operation, the beginning, the critical point of the October 7th operation was the use of these drones to drop munitions, as we're watching here. On that's an automatic machine gun tower. They also did it dropping munitions on surveillance towers, communications, command and control structures of Israel's billion-dollar iron wall that they created. Now we're looking at the surveillance gear, the communications technology that was knocked out before the operation began. And then the second wave of the operation was the breaching operation. And part of that operation was to attack Israeli soldiers stationed along the border. And we're watching right now drone attacks on Israeli bases. And then here we're seeing them on top of tanks. We're seeing with this munition that they're actually dropping Yassin warheads, tandem anti-tank missiles. They're dropping them from the quadcopter here, from the drone. And we can see there the tanks ammunition burn off because of the direct strike. And we see that these tanks don't have what we know that the tanks, by the time the ground invasion began, the tanks had what are called cope cages installed on top of their tanks to protect them from these type of attacks. And we can see in this footage from October 7th that the tanks didn't have that gear. You can see the tank there, direct hit against its ammunition stores at the back of the tank that doesn't have the cope cage. And so the critical element to the October 7th operation was knocking out this billion-dollar wall which separated command and control for the Israeli army that had relied on this surveillance technology in order to monitor the border. So on the October 7th operation, these drones, it wasn't simply drones, it was drones. They also used sniper rifles against these communication systems and automatic machine gun posts, but they went methodically, systematically across the border regions, knocking out each one of these critical towers. And so this is what allowed the operation that ultimately saw the overrunning of the Gaza division. In less than an hour, the Gaza division was overrun and its commanders were captured. And the operation hinged upon these drone operations that we've seen. And maybe we can go to number three here, Tamara. They've used these drone operations. This is the beginning of the ground war. This is in November in Beit Hanun, after the first month of the air war. And you can see in this video the absolute destruction of just those first few weeks of the war. And you can see dangling there, that's the munition, the Qassam-built anti-personnel device. The drone gets right over top of an Israeli forces, looks like they're sitting around lunch there, and the grenade drops right into the middle of the group. So, and we know from Qassam videos before the operation that these were practiced within the Gaza Strip, and it's a very challenging environment because of the surveillance of the Israelis to train with these devices. So it's really remarkable to see the skill with which let's call them the Qassam Air Force, their air control systems technicians are able to execute these operations against both the anti-drone technology that the Israelis have, but also once in position, being able to drop these munitions into the precise spot, accounting for all of the factors that are happening, the wind and whatnot, and landing them in the middle of these troop gatherings. So maybe we go to number four here, Tamara, because when the war began in Khan Yunis in December, one of the first operations in Khan Yunis was to drop a Yassin warhead, tandem charge warhead, on top of a Namur troop carrier there. And we can see the Israeli, two tanks beside that troop carrier. And so the targeting has decided here in this case to choose the personnel carrier, which has 12 soldiers in it, over the tank that's right beside it. But you can see that tank position. And so we saw the videos from October 7th. We saw it from the beginning of the ground war in November in Beit Hanun. And this is the beginning of the ground war in the south in Khan Yunis. Incidentally, 3 months on plus, and the battle in Khan Yunis is still carrying on. And the Israelis had to rotate out their paratroopers brigade out of Khan Yunis. And their commander said that that they weren't able to complete their job of dismantling Hamas. They've been in Khan Yunis for 3 months. The symbolic home of Yahya Sinwar and Mohammed Deif, the leader of the Qassam brigades. No captives have been found. No captive information has been found. No commanders have been taken out in that operation. But the operation from the resistance side began with this targeting by drone of the Israeli military positions on the edge of Khan Yunis. So I just wanted to bring that to people and show the way that Palestinians have been able to use drone technology in this war for the first time that we've seen in this in the history of the conflict, that we've seen them use drones in this way and quite successfully use those drones. So that operation that we began with was just on this weekend, but I just wanted to show you some of the history of the use of the drones during these battles. So maybe we can go to number five here, Tamara. This is in Zaytun. This is Saraya al-Quds, the armed wing of Islamic Jihad, setting up a roadside bomb. And this is the most detailed video that they've shown us of the preparations for this attack this type of attack that we've seen many times in the field reports, but we haven't seen before on video, showing them rigging up multiple explosives, connecting them on the roadside here. And they're going to show us in the next clip here, they're going to show us the Israeli armored column that they know through surveillance is taking the route that they're planting that explosive. So many triangles there showing you. And if you can see on those tanks there, you can see the cope cages on the top of those tanks. They've made them actually into canopies to try to protect against munitions being dropped on top of them. And so here's the remnants of that operation, which I think, so this is the from a tracked vehicle. And I think when Palestinians are able to go back to their homes, we're going to see more of this footage of destroyed armored vehicles. We're already seeing them in the areas that Palestinians are able to return to, that the remnants of these vehicles are around. And it appears, as happened in Lebanon, when one of their armored vehicles was hit, and also when one of their drones was downed in Lebanon, that the Israeli army came back after and bombed the vehicles, the destroyed vehicles, bombed them so that these pieces of the vehicles can't be used to put in museums like the Resistance Museum in South Lebanon, that shows these kind of military trophies, if you will. So you can see there on those tanks, you can see the floor, the reflection is the cope cage that they've built on top of their armored vehicles and installed those directly because of the impact of that October 7th video that I just showed, of the efficacy of dropping munitions on top of the armored vehicles, where they're less less armored, thinner armor on the top than on the hull of the vehicles. And so we see here fighters showing Israeli gear that's left over after that ambush they planted, and they're showing a helmet here that's destroyed. So let's go to number six tomorrow, because Sarael Quds was fighting in Zaytun. The fight in Zaytun has ended. It was a two-week battle that I showed you on the last couple of episodes, and one of the operations that Sarael Quds executed was to rewire an unexploded F-16 American and Israeli bomb dropped on civilian homes in Zaytun, and fighters from Sarael Quds were able to rework that and detonate it against an Israeli force. So if you didn't see last week's show, you should go back and check that out, because that's a pretty remarkable operation that took place. And so this is Sarael Quds showing us their fighters in the battle in Zaytun, and the Israelis withdrew from Zaytun. And it doesn't appear as though they were able to achieve their objectives of attacking a tunnel network that they say. I mean, they say everything is a tunnel network that they're attacking, but the footage of them fighting in tunnels is still non-existent. And their Israeli field reports have really not even bothered with the tunnels, the tunnel operations of late. So the ability for the Israelis to reach the resistance doesn't appear to be impacted by this battle in Zaytun, that Sarael Quds and all of the factions were involved in the battle in Zaytun, which is in Gaza City, an area that the Israelis said that they had full operational control over in early December. Just clearly not the case. Maybe we can go to number seven here tomorrow, because this is also Beit Hanun in the northeast of Gaza, this area that the Israelis said that they had operational control of in late November, and clearly do not. We're watching their forces in view here. We've edited this clip, but this is a sniper operation by the Qassam brigades. We don't see which weapon, if it was a Dragunov or the Al Ghul sniper rifle that we've talked about before on the show. And that second shot just misses that soldier, who presumably will remember that for the rest of his life. That was a very close call from that sniper position. And again, these sniper operations, the drone operations. These are types of operations that we're seeing when the Israelis have withdrawn from the populated areas and are in the buffer zones, believing themselves to be safe, but are well within range of these sniper attacks. And as that drone footage showed, well within range of multiple different types of attacks that I think we're going to see more of if the Israelis intend to stay in this buffer zone for any amount of time. Maybe we go to number 8 tomorrow. This is another Qassam sniper operation. This is in Tel Ahawa in Gaza City. And this fighter says in this Qassam video, "We will hunt you," he says to the Israeli soldiers. "Gaza will be your graveyard." And then he says, which is something we've seen in many of these videos, he says, "We dedicate this operation to the Yemeni resistance and the leader of Ansar Allah, Abdul Malik al-Houthi," and then carries out the sniper operation against an Israeli position. So that's an Al Ghul rifle that he's using there against Israeli forces that are observing on the rooftop there. And again, this is from the other day. And earlier in the day, the same day as this video, Saraya Al-Quds released a video of mortar attacks on Israeli positions. And they dedicated those attacks to the Yemeni, Iraqi, and Lebanese people, who are the other fronts in this battle so far against the Israelis. And I just wanted to show one from, we'll let this one roll one more time through. So this is the Al Ghul sniper rifle. This is the Qassam Brigade's rifle, named after the father of the weapons industry in the Gaza Strip, Adnan Al Ghul, who famously slipped out of Gaza during a manhunt in the late 80s and literally swam back to Gaza with a barrel of TNT to begin rearming during the first intifada. So they've named the rifle after Adnan Al Ghul. And we've seen this rifle be very effective in multiple operations. Qassam says that there's been at least 35 Al Ghul rifle attacks. So sniper attacks and drone operations this week in the Gaza Strip, in the defense of Gaza. Let me just take a quick tour around the other fronts here. In Lebanon, we've been following this. We've been following this development, which is the Hezbollah use of this Almaz top attack anti-tank missile, which was is a reverse engineered anti-tank missile system that was captured by Hezbollah during the 2006 July war. And we're seeing the missile strike coming down here on a Namur troop carrier, again, a 12-person crew in the Namur troop carrier that believes that he's protected behind a berm, but with this Almaz anti-tank missile, they're able to be fired and controlled from a separate location and essentially driven down to hit any target. The missile can rise and drop, and that's what we're seeing here. It coming down on top of a Namur troop carrier. And just to say, Hezbollah said the other day that this is part of 1,200 military operations that they have carried out since October the 8th. That they said of those 1,200, 385 artillery operations, 343 rocket operations, 72 sniper attacks. And what we're watching here is one of 485 anti-tank guided missile attacks that we've seen targeting the Israeli positions inside the evacuated settlements, border posts. 75 of them are against rear bases, rear positions of the Israelis, and targeted 38 drones and planes, and destroyed, according to Hezbollah, 70 vehicles. So we're watching one of the 70 vehicles that they have destroyed. So that's on the Lebanon front. And then maybe after this part here tomorrow, we can skip to number 10. This is an operation in the West Bank in Tulkarm by Saraya Al-Quds and the Tulkarm Brigades against a D9 armored bulldozer, a roadside bomb planted against that Israeli armored vehicle. And we're seeing in the West Bank significant resistance that's been going on even before October 7th, but particularly since October 7th throughout the West Bank. And just yesterday alone, there was 26 resistance operations throughout the West Bank, eight of them armed confrontations, gunfights with the Israeli soldiers. Four of them were IEDs, like we're seeing here, improvised explosive devices being used against invading Israeli forces into the camp. And they went into the camp in Jenin yesterday, as Nora very ably described in the introduction, mechanized invasion into Jenin, which has been a constant focus of the Israeli military and, of course, of the Palestinian resistance going back 100 years in Jenin, literally. So that's the West Bank front that I just wanted to bring in a little bit of Lebanon and the West Bank, because those operations are continuing constantly. And with the beginning of Ramadan, I think we're going to see a lot more action in the West Bank, resistance action in the West Bank, where the Israelis are arresting thousands of people as bargaining chips for this prisoner exchange that is inevitable if Israel is planning on getting their soldiers back. There'll be a prisoner exchange involving many of these people who have been captured since October 7th. And that's something that the Palestinians constantly put in their demands during the prisoner exchange. And we've seen them do that all along, that the previous exchanges have to be lived up to, because the Israelis have actually rearrested Palestinians that were released in the November exchange. Just kind of duplicitous behavior from the Israelis that doesn't really seem to signal an intention to bring back their people in any kind of expeditious fashion here. We're now 6 months on. So that is the resistance report from the Gaza Strip, from Lebanon, and from the West Bank.
Thank you so much, John, as always. Meticulous curation there. Thank you so much. And Ali, Asa, do we have any questions for John about what we just saw and what's happening with the resistance?
John, what's your sense? I mean, it's always fascinating to see these granular videos, which we wouldn't be seeing, as you've made this point repeatedly. We wouldn't be seeing them if the resistance was not filming them, if they didn't have this understanding for the importance of if there's no video, it didn't happen, as the kids say. So they're showing us what's happening. Give us a sense, if you can, in terms of the bigger picture. You've spoken in previous weeks about the Israelis having to introduce obsolete armored vehicles into Gaza, presumably because so many of their vehicles have been damaged. Give us a reading of kind of the big picture. Has that changed? What are you seeing?
Yeah, well, I think the Israelis don't right now have the ability to go into Rafah with all of the threats that they've said, that the Ramadan deadline, that they would go into Rafah. Netanyahu's staking the entire war on the invasion of Rafah. He says that if they're not allowed to go into Rafah, they lose the war, which by implication would mean that they believe they're losing the war today because they're not going into Rafah. And so the supposition is that if you have to go into Rafah to win the war, that you haven't done that. And again, it's tough to know the big picture stuff because the Israelis are lying about the big picture questions. They're clearly covering up their casualties. The statistics coming from Israeli hospitals, from Israeli media reports, isolated cases, nobody's done overall tallies. We know that the hospitals have IDF spokespersons, units, members in every hospital controlling information about hospitals. But we see little information come out about it, like a single hospital in the south having 4,000 people, 4,000 soldiers coming to that hospital, which is a higher number at that single hospital than the Israelis claim have happened in the entire ground war. So I think at some point there'll be the bigger picture numbers will come out. I'm not sure that they're going to overall be able to lie about their casualties. But at this point, we have to just put the pieces together. And when we first did this, these shows early on, I was using armored vehicle numbers that presumed that they wouldn't even go into their Merkava 3 tanks. And they have been going well into that store since December. And we've saw them use those M113s, which is something that the Israelis have a lot of from the Americans, poorly armored vehicles that they sent into Khan Yunis. Again, that hasn't been reported in the Israeli press still. I've been following that to see what the developments are, if they acknowledge that, because it had previously been a scandal, mini scandal inside Israel, that they had sent these lightly armored troop carriers. They'd sent soldiers in them in 2004 in Gaza. They were blown up in Gaza City. And then the 2014 war in Shujaia. So using these vehicles seems to indicate that they don't have enough. They don't have enough vehicles. Yedio Aronot had a story the other day about the armored brigade that's in Gaza, and talked about 650 injuries in the combat injuries in that armored brigade. And what we know about those armored brigades is that we have not seen them in the streets, right? We haven't seen soldiers on foot walking beside these armored vehicles. So that number would seem to indicate they're talking about inside tanks, injuries inside tanks, at least considerable number of those 650 inside tanks. So we get a lot of pieces of information that we try to put together. And part of the reason why the videos are so important is because Israel's blackout of Gaza, which was something they did, the blackout of Gaza was what started the ground invasion. So Israel knocked out the communication systems in Gaza before the ground invasion. And because of that, we don't get the videos like I showed from the West Bank there. That was from somebody in the West Bank recording on their phone that armored vehicle being hit. We haven't seen that kind of footage really from Gaza because of the communications blackout and because of how dangerous it is to actually get your phone to get a signal in Gaza. So we really do rely on these videos from the resistance. And I go through those videos. I'm not just showing every video from the resistance. I'm showing videos that are confirmed, that are possible to confirm that they're not, that what you're seeing is what you're seeing. And so there's lots more videos. There's constant videos of mortar and rocket attacks. Israel hasn't been able to knock out the rockets. Qassam the other day at the beginning of Ramadan published a video with one of their fighters walking around their M90 rockets, which can hit Tel Aviv, all ready to fire, all with their fuses in place. And so a lot of the Israeli propaganda of being able to knock out the rockets, which is a prerequisite for Israelis going back to the Gaza envelope, if that's ever going to happen. They've said the people who left the envelope and are living in hotels in Jerusalem said that they're not going to come back to the Gaza envelope until rocket fire is stopped. And the Palestinians show that that capacity still exists. And of course, the same is in the north. They say the Israelis aren't going back to their settlements in the north unless Hezbollah's Radwan units are pushed off the border. And there's no indication that that's going to happen without either a ground invasion or, as Hezbollah said, without a fair prisoner exchange and a diplomatic ending to this conflict, which Israel has the opportunity to do at any point and bring home their people. But they simply refuse to do that. So the big picture analysis for Israel is really that they haven't achieved any of their goals, not the goals that they stated to their public, not the goals they stated to their military. They haven't achieved any of those goals and are now waiting outside of Rafah, presumably building up their force that has been depleted through the ground invasion that's 130 days of ground invasion old. So it's hard to know the big picture successes that Israel is going to rely on to try to get themselves out of this war, because there really is very thin. I mean, the military justification for committing a genocide against 2 million civilians is a significant bar that Israel hasn't even come close to. We're just seeing a war on civilians, and the resistance is still able, capably able to fight back after all of this time. They're still in positions. And as soon as the Israelis come into any area, they're immediately met by resistance, which incidentally is the case all over Palestine. In any time the Israelis are present in a military force, there's resistance, be it stone throwing by kids in their schools when their schools are shut down, or there's Israeli forces outside their schools, all the way up to the very sophisticated military operation that we saw on October 7th that the U.S. Army report said was an exceptional military operation that was carried out by what would be elite special forces in any national army. And so from the lowest, from the smallest kid to the most sophisticated special forces, the Palestinians are constantly resisting the occupation. And it's impossible for Israel to achieve what it believes are its goals against the resistance. And so that's why they're targeting civilians. And that's why the war is against civilians as a terror war, to essentially attempt to separate the population from the resistance. And that just never works.
No.
Can I make one quick point just to back up what you said about, John, what you said about the Israeli settlers from the kibbutzim. If you, Tamari, can you put this screenshot up on the screen? It's from the recent report about alleged sexual violence that took place in the 7th of October attack. And I've covered that in a separate article that we talked about on last week's stream. But as an aside, it mentioned this. It just says, as of the last government update on Israeli government update on November 2023, 98.3% of the population that lived within 0 to 4 kilometers of the Gaza perimeter fence were displaced. At 4 to 7 kilometers, 78.4% were displaced. And from the city of Sderot, 81.9% of the population were displaced. So that, you know, this is a very recent report, and that was the most up-to-date figures we've got. So I think we can say, you know, that the Israeli settlers from the so-called Gaza envelope have not returned, and there's no sign of them returning anytime soon.
Right, and the same with the settlements in northern historic Palestine.
This is still a closed military zone. You can't go into these areas. We know of journalists who have attempted to visit some of these areas, and they can't get they haven't yet received the authorization to go.
But we've seen them allow protesters to bring their infant children to block the aid shipments. And so the journalists can't access the closed military zone, but the Israelis are allowing.
They're encouraging it.
Yeah. And they're also, of course, taking foreign dignitaries on these propaganda tours to these areas as well.
But yeah, about Asa's point, it's the buffer zones of Israel are now inside the state of Israel. It's a significantly smaller state than it was on October 7th. And none of this genocide has pointed in any way to them recouping that land that's lost. And that's a significant strategic question for Israel, that, you know, they've postponed a lot of these conversations because they've said, you know, we're not going to look into the failures of the military on October 7th until after the war. And so they've avoided this, but there's going to be years of these kind of inquests, investigations into showing the strategic defeat that Israel has faced, and, killing 35,000 civilians is not changing that military reality at all.
Yeah. And meanwhile, there are constantly new revelations, new reports, new evidence and footage of Israel, of Israeli forces shooting and killing their own civilians on October 7th. Ali and Asa, both of you have been reporting on some of these new so-called friendly fire incidents. Bring us up to date on what's happening with that.
Yeah, yesterday, along with David Sheen, I published an article at the Electronic Intifada. And there it is. The headline is "Released Captive Tells How Israeli Fire Killed Kibbutz Resident." And the focus of the story is an Israeli woman called Shani Goren, who lived in a settlement called Kibbutz near Oz, which is one of these settlements in the so-called Gaza envelope. And on October 7th, she was taken by Palestinian fighters along with several other kibbutz residents, and with the intent to take them captive in Gaza. She was actually taken to Gaza and spent, I think it was 55 days there before being released and returned safely home in November during the truce and the prisoner exchange. And she gave a long interview about her experience on Israel's Channel 12, one of its main TV channels, to Ilana Dayan. And Ilana Dayan, some people might remember, is the famous Israeli journalist who helped General Barak Hiram try to cover up his shelling of a home in Kibbutz Be'eri on October 7th, killing a number of Israeli civilians there. But in this interview, Ilana Dayan is talking to Shani Goren. And this was broadcast in Israel just last month, so very recently. Even though she was released in November, she didn't really speak about her experiences until very recently. And let's just start with showing a clip from this interview, which we have translated and subtitled, and you can watch the full segment in the article on the Electronic Intifada. But we're just going to show a clip now.
בשעה רבע לשבע ואנחנו במשדר חדשות מיוחד בעקבות מתח טילים ורקטות שנורא לשטח ישראל.
קשרת לעמית, הוא אומר לי, קומי, נעלי את הדלת, סגרי את הכל, את לא זזה מהבית. תרים את הידית של הממד ותישארי שם.
עמית, אחיה, לא היה בניר עוז באותה שבת. שירה אחותה הייתה בקיבוץ.
Yeah, let's pause it there for a second, Tamara. Let's go back to the beginning, and I'm actually going to read or summarize the subtitles because I know that some people are listening, and I think that will be helpful for people. So this is in Hebrew, obviously, and we hear the narration from Ilana Dayan, and then we're going to hear Shani Goren speaking. It's 6:45, and this is a special news broadcast. In the wake of a volley of missiles and rockets shot into Israeli territory, I call my brother Amit and he tells me, get up, lock the door, shut everything, do not step out of the house. Lift the handle of the safe room and stay there. Her brother Amit was not in Nir Oz that Saturday. Her sister Shira was at the kibbutz, as was her good friend Arbel Yehud, still at her home at this stage. I spoke with Arbel. We were both stressed. This is Shira talking. We couldn't speak. We said we loved each other. We hoped they wouldn't reach us and nothing would happen. From that moment, she was on the line with her brother's partner the whole time, the narrator says. And then Shani, Nofar called me. I spoke with her for 2 hours. You just held each other on the line. Yes, later she told me it had been 2 hours. From my perspective, we spoke for half an hour. I tell her, I'm scared, and she says, breathe. And then suddenly there were noises in the house. I whisper to her, Nofar, they're here, they're here. She tells me, okay, be quiet, breathe. I'm with you on the line. I was covered under the blanket. crunched up, trying to stay close to the closet in case they come. And then the door opened quietly and they tossed in a grenade. Let's stop there with this video. Tamara, I actually think I wanted to show another clip as well that I didn't send you. While I talk about this, this is the clip that we cut yesterday for Twitter, the short clip where she's talking by the fence and telling what happened when that happened. I apologize to Tamara for not having provided her with that clip earlier. But what I want to say about Shani Goren, who you see in this video, is she tells the whole story to Ilana Dayan of how she the Palestinian fighters entered the kibbutz. She tells a very important story. You see the beginning of it there, where they come into her home. She is alone at home. They have total control of the kibbutz. And there's another aspect to this story where what I'm going to show you in a minute is the clip where she's explaining the friendly fire incident. And that's the clip that we cut yesterday. But in this incident, she talks about when the fighters come in, she's completely alone in the house in bed. They have complete control over the kibbutz. And I think there's an important point here which relates to what we've spoken about in previous incidents in previous live streams regarding the allegation of mass rape. And we talked about the really fraudulent UN report last week. But this incident that Shani Goren tells, if anything, I think is relevant to that, because they come in, she's in her bedroom alone, she's in bed. According to her description, she is wearing very little in bed. And she's alone with these fighters. And the first thing they do is they grab some clothes from her closet and they tell her, get dressed. And of course, that can't tell you that no sexual violence happened anywhere else. But what it does provide you with is an example of where, if these fighters had been ordered, as Israel claims, to carry out those kinds of attacks, this was the perfect opportunity, and nothing like that happened to her there or in Gaza. And I just want to note that. And again, Tamara, I'm sorry for messing up with the video clip I sent you. I don't know if we have the friendly fire clip now that we wanted to, that was in our feed from yesterday. But basically, what Shani Goren talks about is when the Palestinians had secured the kibbutz and they'd captured a number of people, they put them on on a tuk-tuk. This is an open cart tractor that's used around the kibbutz for landscaping and so on. And they started to drive back to Gaza. And I think we have that clip now where Shani Goren tells us what happened as they headed towards the boundary with Gaza. And this is, yeah. So let's just pause it so that I can give the narration as well. And so again, it switches between the narrator and the testimony of Shani Goren. So let's go. What will happen in another moment has almost never been discussed until now. The captives are already in the vehicle, surrounded by terrorists on all sides, on the way to Gaza. We exit from here, turn left, drive on this path we see here. Yes, we drive, and then there is a right turn, and we see nothing. What do you mean you see nothing? Nothing, no army, totally empty. You still expect them? Yes, you always expect to see them, Shani responds. She won't see a single soldier, the narrator says, but suddenly from the sky, a sound is heard that sparks an ember of hope. And 150 meters before the border, we suddenly hear a combat helicopter in the skies. The combat helicopter coming up over them sees from the cockpit what obviously he never could have imagined. Streams of terrorists and Israeli civilians among them being taken captive to Gaza. The helicopter accompanied you for a fair while. I don't remember exactly how long, but it was there. We say, good, maybe the army is here. Maybe something is happening. And something, in fact, from the helicopter's direction within minutes happens. And then suddenly it opened fire with a volley coming from above. Yes. The time is now 11:30 a.m. The helicopter pilot makes a decision in a nearly impossible situation. It aims gunfire at the small vehicle laden with terrorists, but also with Israeli captives. It was a terrifying moment. It lasts just seconds. I lower my head, Shani says. I realize my pants are all ripped and covered in blood. I raise my head and I see dominoes. All the terrorists dead. And then she, one of the captives, Doron's mother, suffers a lethal wound from the gunfire. Sadly, Efrat Katz was killed on the spot. And that's a picture of Efrat Katz, who's 68, a resident of a kibbutz near Oz. Do you manage to see Efrat? Yes. That's one of the memories you're trying to erase. Yes. To erase. Yes. So that's just a clip of Shani Garen recounting the killing of 68-year-old Efrat Katz from kibbutz near Oz, who was riding on that tuk-tuk. And her daughter, Doron, Efrat Katz's daughter, Doron, and her two children were also on that cart, on that motorized cart. Doron was injured. Shani Goren was, another woman called Naomit Chendekel was also severely injured and also lived to tell the tale. They all tell the same story of the helicopter coming and firing without regard to who was on the cart. And just an interesting note about Efrat Katz and also the history of kibbutz near Oz. Tamara, maybe we can show the site, the decolonizer site that I showed you earlier, and scroll down to the handwritten notes that are on that page. But an organization called Decolonizer, which does education about the Nakba, actually held an exhibition in Al-Ma'in. Al-Ma'in is the name of the village that existed where kibbutz near Oz and several other kibbutzes now sit near Gaza. And this village of Al-Ma'in, most of that land was inhabited by and worked and belonged to the Abu Sitte family. You'll hear the name Abu Sitte in many reports from Gaza. Several of our writers at the Electronic Intifada are named Abu Sitte. And of course, famously, there's the Palestinian geographer and historian Salman Abu Sitte, who's authored several important books about the Nakba, including the Atlas of Palestine. And this exhibition was hosted in the last standing house of Al-Ma'in. And several kibbutz residents from the nearby kibbutzes actually came and attended the exhibition. One of them was Efrat Katz. And if we scroll down, we actually see there's a handwritten note from Efrat Katz that she wrote after it may not be visible on this page, but she actually wrote a handwritten message where she just said that she regretted that the people who are originally from that land that she now lives on are no longer there. But I just thought this connection was so poignant, because Salman Abu Sitte, wrote a few years ago in an article about this exhibition. I think this is the page, Tamara, I'll drop this in the chat here, that has the handwritten note from Efrat Katz, maybe not showing up. But Salman Abu Sitte also wrote about this exhibition and what he remembers as a little boy during the Nakba, when he was became a refugee. And he actually says, yeah, there's the handwritten note on the left from Efrat Katz. She talks about, you know, I mean, it's just sort of expressing this positive sentiment. Although most of the people who went to the exhibition, according to Salman Abu Sitte, he even writes, the angriest comments and indeed threats came from an old kibbutznik over 80 who witnessed and participated in the attacks on Al Ma'in. And he says, again, this is Salman Abu Sitte writing about the attack on Al Ma'in by Zionist militias, the Haganah, which actually happened on the 14th of May, 1948. So that was the very day that the State of Israel was declared. The Zionists attacked Al Ma'in and destroyed and burned homes, demolished the school that was built in 1920, blew up the motorized well and the flour mill. That's what Salman Abu Sitte wrote. He also writes, they were resisted bravely for several hours by 15 Palestinian defenders armed by old rifles. As a child, I witnessed the smoldering remains of my village while I was huddled with other children and women in a nearby ravine. I never saw a Jew before and did not know who the attackers were or why they came to destroy our life. And I just thought of that image of the Palestinian fighters on this land in 1948, trying to defend the village. And then 75 years later, in a sense, the reverse, the Palestinians coming to reclaim their land and Zionists defending the stolen land and the new colonies that have been put on it. That's sort of a tangent to the story, but what the story tells us, Shani Goren's testimony is really of another significant data point of how much friendly fire there was on October 7th.
On a recent episode of the Makdisi Street podcast, Salman Abu Sitte was talking about Al Ma'in and his childhood and his expulsion and the kibbutz, the settlement of Nir Oz, and he said that actually, you know, 10 years before, the residents of Al Ma'in, safe housed Palestinian Jews who were being repressed by British forces at the time in the 1930s, and they hid Jews in their homes. They, you know, accepted them and welcomed them and protected them. And then Salman says that 10 or 12 years later, those same exact people who they had protected were now part of the Haganah, and they were the ones destroying the village of Al Ma'in and forcibly displacing and ethnically cleansing the villagers. And it's just one of many countless stories.
And all these settlements in the so-called Gaza envelope, again, the term envelope is an Israeli term that describes what they were trying to do to Gaza, to contain it. You put something in an envelope. But all of these settlements were built on ethnically cleansed land, on villages like Al Ma'in, with the purpose of preventing the return of the Palestinians who belong to this land and whose land this is. Often they were actually military garrisons like Nahal Oz, which was founded by soldiers of the Nahal Brigade and was a military garrison and then later became a so-called civilian settlement, although none of them really are really civilian. So, I mean, they're civilian in the sense that Israel uses civilians as human shields for its land theft. Land that it has stolen, it sticks civilian settlers on and then and uses them literally to protect itself from Palestinian resistance. But really, I hope people will read the story because it, you know, again, this is an example of Israeli media, not to idealize Israeli media because it's still extremely biased and propagandistic, but to say that even Israeli media is talking about Israel killing its own citizens. And as we talked about last week with Bryce Green, the U.S. media is simply ignoring this. You can get these testimonies in Israeli media, but not in the New York Times and the Washington Post and CNN. But Asa, throwing this over to you, we may be able to get some of it more from Al Jazeera very soon, right?
Yeah, hopefully. Just one quick point on the kibbutzim. A comment from a viewer here, Israel uses kibbutzim as human shields. There is one of these kibbutzim which is literally called Magen, which is Hebrew for shield. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that kind of says it all. There's a point that I've made in previous articles about the 7th of October military assault. And it's not so, you know, like you said, Ali, it's not so easy to call these settlements civilian settlements because, yes, there are civilians in them, but they kind of blur the line in a lot of ways. You know, there are military encampments in them quite a lot of the time. And
most of the time, yeah. I mean, yeah. there's at least, you know, surveillance towers and outposts, yeah.
Yeah. So, yes, on the Al Jazeera documentary, yeah, I wrote this article this week about this new Al Jazeera documentary, which should be coming out soon, hopefully. Our understanding now is that it should hopefully come out next week. They've released some clips about it, but we've managed to view it. And what it does confirm is what we've been reporting all along, which is that Israel did kill Israelis on the 7th of October. And it's an interesting documentary, like one of the most interesting. I think all of us here have seen it now, actually. And yeah, it'd be interesting to get all your takes on it, actually. The thing I found most interesting about it that was useful to me was they interviewed this former British military officer and artillery officer, Chris Cobb Smith. And, you know, our regular viewers and listeners will know how many times we've seen we've played on this live stream footage and images like this. There's one on the screen here from one of the kibbutzes. And we've said so many times, you know, usually more dramatic footage than this, where there's complete, as this military officer describes it, you know, catastrophic structural damage of kibbutzim houses completely flattened, essentially looking very similar to what's going on in Gaza. And we've said, you know, so many times, there's no way that was done by Hamas because they have you know, they have light weapons, they have RPGs and so forth. But here in this documentary, you have a former British artillery officer, nonetheless, saying there's no way this was exactly what we were saying, but, you know, sort of validating it from a military perspective, from an actual, you know, military expert who has been in an army. And even in the case of this particular photo on the screen here, which I wouldn't have been so, you know, personally certain about, that it couldn't have been done. He said that was not done by RPGs. That was his view, that would have been done by a heavy weapon system. The implication being that it could only have been done by the Israelis. So that's something, you know, that's a validation that I found there from it.
Yeah, it's a good, as Asa said, we were able to preview it, and I hope everyone will be able to watch it very soon. in the next few days. I hope and expect Al Jazeera will air it. It's a good film. It you know, of course, as with anything, you watch it and you think, I might have made a different choice. But overall, it tells the story. It addresses the reality of what happened and also what didn't happen. It really does a good job showing just how much lying Israel and its various spokespeople have done about October 7th, including the fake, you know, all the fake atrocity stories about beheaded babies and so on. And I think they do count a sort of a minimum number of people they could say with some certainty were likely killed by Israeli forces on October 7th. But yeah, we can't take that. And I'm not sure how much of the film we should reveal, because we were allowed to see a preview, but I think we should, I don't know how much we should say, yeah, but basically, sorry.
I think we're allowed to say what we're
okay.
Seen.
All right. Well, that's fine. Yeah. So they put a figure of several dozen that they could confirm. I don't remember the exact number, but it's in that order that they could confirm were killed in these friendly fire incidents. But I think the important takeaway from that is this is a minimum. These are the ones they could say with certainty. What they're not accounting for is, for example, those huge scenes we saw of dozens or hundreds of incinerated cars shot by helicopters. Remember, of course, the 200 people that Israel admitted they couldn't tell if they were, Palestinians or Israelis. So I think the film is important in sort of taking stock of what we know up to this point. And again, doing that within their constraints of, you know, they've only got 50 minutes or whatever it is to do it. But it's not a substitute for a full investigation and continued investigation of what happened on October 7th. So it's great. I think they did a great job with it. But, we'll still need to keep pulling at some of these threads. And I can tell you we're working on additional stories on October 7th that we'll be looking forward to telling you about in coming weeks.
Yeah, for sure. And before we wrap, I just wanted to kind of get everyone's thoughts on this so-called maritime corridor and this very vaunted plan by the U.S. To build a pier. We kind of discussed it last week, talked about the theatrics of it, how it's a total just farce. You know, they won't pressure Israel to open the crossings to let these thousands of aid trucks in, but they're going to do this dramatic theater of building some sort of port that will take months. What do we know about the port and about, how this is all kind of faring?
Well, I want to point to what Walat said when we spoke to Walat Sabah earlier in the live stream, and she pointed to the suspicions that Palestinians in Gaza have about this, and I would say Palestinians more generally outside Gaza have about this. And in recent days, the very well-known Palestinian commentator Abdel Bari Atwan, for example, has been expressing a lot of these fears and concerns. I mean, the basic question is, why do you need a maritime corridor? As we've pointed out when we talked about these symbolic airdrops last week, or these public relations stunts airdrops last week, why do you need to do airdrops when there is 2,000 trucks fully loaded, stuck at the Rafah crossing solely because Israel doesn't want them to come in to Gaza? And what is making people even more suspicious is the fact that Yoav Gallant, the Israeli defense minister and the architect of the starvation policy, remember it was Yoav Gallant on October 9th, who announced that they were cutting off food, water, medicine, everything to the so-called human animals in Gaza. Why would he welcome this maritime corridor, which is what he did a couple of days ago? And he let the cat out of the bag. He said that this is going to be basically Israel's way of replacing UNRWA, the UN Agency for Palestine Refugees that Israel has been trying to destroy, in the United States and its allies have been helping them by defunding it. So I would say a lot of the suspicions. Oh, the other thing is that the Americans have said they're sending a Navy, the Navy or U.S. forces to build this floating offshore port or whatever it is, but there will be no U.S. boots on the ground in Gaza. But you have to have someone on the ground to unload and process and distribute this aid. And we already know Israel doesn't want it to be UNRWA. So who is it going to be? And in this context, it's been announced that the aid is going to be coordinated with the UAE, the United Arab Emirates. But it's unspecified what the UAE's role will be. Will they be funding it? Or will they be providing boots on the ground? So there is a lot of suspicion that this is really a Trojan horse to create basically a bridgehead to introduce an alternative collaborationist government to Gaza, hearkening back to some of the early talk of the so-called day after when it was mooted that Arab, so-called Arab peacekeeping forces might be brought in. None of this has been announced or clarified, just to make that clear. But this is the suspicions that this is raising, and this is what's being talked about among Palestinians. And I think it was in the Washington Post that American officials have said that even if this port were fully up and running, it would be able to process at a maximum, again, this is assuming everything goes perfectly, at a maximum the equivalent of 200 truckloads of aid per day, which we know is far, far short of what's needed. And this would not stop a famine from happening. And that's assuming it happens. And it's not going to happen for at least 2 months from what we've heard. So, and then finally, another fear is that it is going to be used, if it is set up, to bypass the Rafah crossing, to basically cut Gaza off completely by land from Egypt, and to replace the one land crossing to the outside world with a sea crossing that is totally under American and Israeli control and the control of collaborators of the United States and Israel and enemies of the Palestinian people. Yeah. So that's what, rather than generating appreciation or relief that more aid is coming in, this thing has only raised a lot more questions and fears. And that's some of what Wala alluded to.
John, did you want to chime in about the port?
Any thoughts? Just the 200 trucks a day is less than half of what the siege levels were before the war.
Yeah.
So even if that were to be the case, it doesn't appear to be a beneficial. It feels as though they're just making this stuff up as they go, because these American soldiers are on their way over, 500 of them, to rig up this pier that has to attach to the shoreline in Gaza. So this idea that there won't be boots on the ground just presumes some sort of force accepting these soldiers and building the pier with them. They haven't even declared the ship that left from Cyprus. They haven't even declared where it's going to arrive on the beach. They haven't declared the position where the dock is going to be implemented. And like you said, it's going to be 60 days before that. And people are dying today. And there's trucks that you could literally open the border and allow hundreds and hundreds of them to come in immediately. If this is theater, it's the most grisly type of theater while people are starving to death. It's really astonishing because...
And it may well be theater, but let's remember that these plans or ideas for a port as an alternative to ending the siege, but a port that would be under Israeli control, date back several years. And you remember... towards the beginning of this genocide, the Israeli minister, I think it was Israel Katz, who talked about building an island off Gaza, a floating right. island. And people said, oh, they want to exile Palestinians to a floating island. I don't think that's actually what he meant. I think he meant something like this, where a maritime corridor with an offshore element, whether that be an artificial island, a floating island, or whether it be Cyprus, as a terminal, become the only outlet for Gaza and its people to the outside world, with the understanding that it is under the full control of Israel and other genocidal enemies of the Palestinian people, including the United States and the European Union. So I think there is an element of their making it up as they go along, but they're also bringing up ideas that or looking around and saying, well, what do we already have in the in-tray that's an idea that we can revive? And there was actually even a report in the Jerusalem Post yesterday, I think, saying that this idea of the port was actually an Israeli idea that came from Netanyahu to Biden. And as I mentioned, Yoav Gallant, the defense minister, is saying this will be how we replace UNRWA. So it's one of those things where there's a lot that is unclear, but there is enough background to this. And again, with plans going back several years, to be really concerned that they are trying, that this is another attempt to control Gaza's fate long-term, under the really cynical and cruel guise of humanitarian aid.
Oh, it's grotesque. And I just wanted to also alert our viewers and listeners that Tamara Nassar is putting the finishing touches on her post about the pier and highlighting a lot of analyses by various folks around the region who are looking at this very carefully. So be sure to look out for that. Hopefully it'll be published today. And with that, Asa, let's go to some comments of people.
Thanks, Nora. Okay, I'm going to try and flash up some on the screen as I read them. There's loads. These are the... all the different places. Okay, so Liverpool, Germany, Montreal, Houston, British Columbia, London, China, Norfolk, Cairo, Atlanta, Georgia, California, India, Scotland, Liverpool, Ireland, Lisbon, Shamai O'Gumry, hello from Wales. Brighton, Indonesia, San Diego, Five Scotland, New Jersey, Portland, Oregon, and many more. Thank you very much, everybody. Tanwi, a regular viewer, says Electronic Intifada tells the truth and exposes the lies and distortions, and that we should be commended. Thank you, Tanwi. No, Savvy Bite says Nora is a queen. Thank you.
No monarchies on the show.
Well, you know, I think we can allow that one. Queen of the podcast. Yeah, that's the idea. Let's see. Yeah, we had lots of support for our guests as well, as always. And also, we always get comments commemorating our dear friend Rifat. who was mentioned earlier in the podcast. Thank you for that. Thanks to Huda and Walat as well earlier on in the show. And Tanweer again wants to promote John Elmer to field marshal.
Wow.
Yeah.
You're rising through the ranks faster than Israeli soldiers do.
EI does not have a military wing.
Yeah.
Just to clarify. We do analysis.
Yes.
Which is very important since no one else is doing it, at least not so brilliantly.
Sorry to embarrass Nora again, but I thought this was nice because this viewer says, special thanks to Nora for the weekly news updates. I tried to keep the vigil group for Palestine informed, mostly based on her overview. Keep up the great work. So, you know, that shows that, you know, our work is being used by local activists. So we appreciate that feedback. Thank you for that.
Thank you.
And also, Mohammed says, when will Tamara be on the live stream? Tamara does come on the live stream. You know,
and also,
Tamara is with us every live stream.
Yeah, she's like, exactly. You know,
she does come on sometimes.
She makes it work. She makes it work very well. And of course, just a reminder that Tamara will be on the live. She has been, she will be again, certainly. But also Tamara has done some wonderful recorded interviews with various guests that we mentioned last week. And just shout out again. So on the YouTube channel, you'll find those conversations between Tamara and some really interesting guests, most recently Stephen Salaita, that are well worth watching.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes, and with that, go to our YouTube stream, sign up for, subscribe to the channel so you can get notified for new podcasts and live streams that are coming up. Go over to electronicintifada.net, sign up for our mailing list. You all know the drill. Like and subscribe, do all the things. Check out our front page this week. We have many new features by our contributors in Gaza, as well as news and analysis on the right-hand side of the page.
And I just want to shout out the story that's on the front page right now, at the top there. Gaza genocide ignored when EU approved new deals for Israel. And this is by our colleague, David Cronin. And this is a latest update on a story that he broke last week about how the EU has just given a new dollop of funding to an Israeli company that is directly involved in the genocide, Israel Aerospace Industries. And so that information is also extremely important, again, highlighting the complicity and possible criminal liability of various EU and other government officials who engage in this kind of activity. So I think that's a great story as well. We are trying to hold all these forces accountable to the extent that we can. And then back on the front page, if we see one of the features there is by our contributor, Dunya Abu Sitta. And I just mentioned in the earlier segment about the Abu Sitta family. This is a major family in Gaza. But of course, they are, like most people in Gaza, refugees from the lands from which their parents and grandparents were ethnically cleansed in order to make way for the kibbutzes that are now around Gaza. And the other stories there on the front page include one by Amjad Diari, who is in Gaza and is still reporting and telling important stories. And that one is about his cousin, Mohammed Yari, a photographer who is now among the more than 100 journalists who have been murdered in this genocide by Israel. And there's also a story from a news story from Susan Abulhawa, the novelist and writer who, as we mentioned, just returned from Gaza 2 weeks ago. And she is contributing, she's already contributed more than one piece to us about what she saw in Gaza herself, which she said is far worse than she could have imagined. And that's just a few of the fantastic stories that we're publishing.
Yeah. And finally, we have some new fan art by one of our members of the audience. Again, Ibrahim Abu Sitta, who also of the Abu Sitta clan, who sent us some fan art a few weeks ago, and he sent us a new one. I just love it. It's phenomenal. Thank you so much, Ibrahim.
It's really charming, we enjoy seeing it. Thank you. Yeah,
thanks, Ibrahim.
Thank you. Yeah, it's beautiful work. And if you're an artist out there and want to send in your fan art, we are always very pleased to accept it and show it on EI. So thanks for that. And with that, Tamara Nassar, thank you for all the phenomenal direction and production, as always. John, Asa, and Ali, thank you all as well. And we'll see you guys next week.
Thank you.